Hello, I'm Ray Dalio, and I'm happy to be here with Paul Volcker, who is my greatest hero, and probably to many people, the greatest living American. And that's a big statement. I've watched Paul evolve since 1970, when he was Undersecretary of the Treasury and Monetary Affairs, all the way through the present. And during those years, he had more effect on the world economy and built up more credibility and has been at the center of more economic decision-making than any man alive. In his 91 years, he's affected the world in profound ways, some of which are very famous and some of which are just a reflection of his credibility. For example, when the controversial issue, of the monies that Jews were lost in the Holocaust went into Swiss banks, and that very delicate subject, very different from regular economics, the man that they chose to examine that question was Paul Volcker. Paul, in many, many different occasions, and at many different times, shaped many, many different issues. So this is a man who has extraordinary principles. I've known him to be the most principled person that I know, and also to been at the center of most important economic decision-making during those many, many years, for many decades, and to see things from the top. This is a man with great perspective, and so I'm here today to pull out the principles from Paul and to understand how he got those principles. So, Paul, to start off, please give me what you consider to be what your most important principles are.
Well, first of all, thank you for those very generous comments. And let me say I'm glad to see you here at this point. I've been a little under the weather. I hope I'm recovering. But, you know, it's a book I just wrote. We've got something to talk about. You ask about my principles, and the first thing that comes to mind, which I'm sure we'll get to later, is my first principle is effective governance. And I go back, and we can discuss this in more detail. Alexander Hamilton put it all in a nutshell. Alexander Hamilton is an old Treasury guy. He's a financial guy. He restored the credit of the United States, so he's a hero of mine. He said the true test of good government is his ability to administer. Not the great policy, but can they carry out the policies effectively and economically? And good government is not just high policy, it's making the machine work day after day efficiently. Faith of the American people in our government today is really distressing. There have been polls taken every year, ask the same question and see how the trend changes. Do you trust your government to do the right thing most of the time? Didn't sound the right thing most of the time. Didn't sound like all that a difficult to test. You get maybe 20% to say yes. You ask about the Congress, it'll be less than 20%. And it's no great secret that we're torn apart by ideological and other differences now. So we got a real challenge. So when you ask my principles, my first principle is good governance. When you talk about principles that go down in the family end, we were not a family that spent money easily. We liked to economize and be sure how we were spending money. I'd like to think we carry this over, or I carry it over when I had some responsibilities in government to try to do it sufficiently, not only as accurately, but as efficiently as possible. You know, my father, he took over as city manager of this bankrupt town in 1930 and lasted for 20 years, but he became the principal figure in the town. There's no question he was the best known and fortunately highly respected. But he was a fanatic for disclosure. He would do a very detailed budget every year and distribute it to everybody in town. And it went down to how many police cars they bought, how many fire engines they bought. And he professionalized the police department and the fire department to two departments that are essential, obviously, in any town. And he was a bug for not spending more than he had to spend, but spend what was necessary for a professional operation.
It appears that he had a profound impact on your life. You were born in 1927. This was 2 years before the stock market crash and the Great Depression. In 1930, at the beginning of the Great Depression, he took you and the family to Teaneck, New Jersey. By the way, read about this in this book because it's the building of a great man and a system to build a great system. And he came as the manager of that town. I'm going to read a quote of your father's that relates to what you're saying. Government is a science, and I'm happy that the officials and the people of this community agree that the man who is the manager should be thoroughly trained in the science of government. And in that part of the book, you also refer to that it was a solidly middle-class town, and you referred to his good education, his basic good solid education. And in the book, you talk about your good solid education. You talk about the importance of family and the science of government, the idea of that good management. And you refer to its outcomes, that there was no crime in Teaneck, New Jersey. The Saturday Evening Post wrote an article that's entitled, "There is no crime in Teaneck, New Jersey, because it was well managed, because there's a middle class, because there's good education." I'm interested in what you think is happening to infrastructure, education, family, middle class, and government management. And you expressed worries about the United States' position in the world. Do you think these things are related? What are your thoughts about those?
All these things you say are very familiar. But I grew up precisely at the time when I graduated from high school or college. World War II was over. The United States had won the war, in our opinion. It rules the world. It developed presumably a multicultural, multilateral system of governance and mutual growth. It all seemed very successful. We kind of forget that we had two miserable wars in Vietnam and then in Iraq. But by and large, I grew up in a world where, you know, I moved in the United States Treasury. I felt the kingpin of treasuries around the world.
Because, you were.
Well, I when the U.S. Treasury was.
Yes, the U.S. Treasury
and,
was.
And the Federal Reserve. That's different now. We're learning in a world where we're still top dog, maybe, but the top dog isn't so readily recognized by others as it was. And we obviously have the rise of China as a clear competitor for world influence. And how that all works out, we'll see. But it's not the comfortable world of assumed leadership that I grew up with. And that's what I struggled with in the Treasury and then later in the Federal Reserve. There are other forces. The rest of the world is growing, some of it more rapidly than we. When I was in the Federal Reserve, Japan was the big question as to the rival of the United States. They're growing very rapidly, has very good success economically. We kind of forget about that now as things change. Now it's China. But we have to learn in a world in which we leadership by America is not taken for granted anymore. And I'm afraid that's been speeded up by what's been happening in Washington and in the country in the last 4 or 5 years.
How so?
We obviously got this divisiveness in the Congress, divisiveness in the country. It's made it impossible to take very coherent, consistent approaches toward domestic problems, but particularly toward foreign policy. And that sense, again, that we are the natural leader, we have certain allies that seem permanent 10 to 15 years ago, don't seem so permanent anymore. It's a tougher situation that we have to accommodate to that makes some emphasis on effective government all the more important in my mind. Who is going to appreciate the United States as a leader if we don't seem to be able to manage our own affairs at home.
You keep referring to management of the government.
Right.
And your father was the manager, and you've been
right.
around the management of all governments
right.
around the world. You've also explained that the discouragement of government workers to be professional managers. Could you embellish on that point? I know this is maybe probably your greatest mission is to have a beneficial impact on that.
Yes, but you know, there are 2 million employees in federal employees, not counting the Army and the Air Force and so forth. 2 million civilian employees, which is exactly the same amount we had back in the Kennedy administration, which is 80 years ago, I guess. And you ask, how is the government operating? Same number of people. It does an awful lot of outsourcing, out-contracting. You ask the question, who? The Defense Department itself outsources $300 billion a year or more. Who's minding the store? And I'm not sure we're well enough equipped for those 2 million people. I headed a commission on the civil service when I left the Federal Reserve, which was in 1987. And it was a big commission. We had ex-vice presidents, we had ex-cabinet officers, we had congressmen, we had a lot of people. We issued a good report. What impact did it have? Very little, about how you needed to develop a more effective civil service. Make it easier to hire, make it easier to fire, get the right leadership in there, which some departments have and some do not have. 5 years later, I headed another commission, much smaller commission, with another good report. But what impact does it have? Not enough. One of the observations that's often struck me is there's a feeling by, you know, many businessmen, the government is not efficient, doesn't do things right, it's filled with a lot of time servers that aren't very helpful, which obviously there are isolated places where all those things are true. But by and large, I have been struck by the number of businessmen who have been called in the government for a secretary or something or other, undersecretary in the White House, whoever, who after 2 or 3 years in government say, I didn't realize there were so many people in the government that knew what they were doing and could do it effectively. And it's one of the biggest experiences I take away from my years in government, that it's much more effective, potentially, with a better staffing than I thought. But that's a hard lesson to sell generally. And it's not always true. We have to improve the damn thing. And that's what I'm after.
At this point in your life, the thing that you have devoted the most to is the proper professionalization,
right.
education of government managers. You've created the Volcker Alliance, in which you've devoted most of your net worth to, in order to foster the proper development of government workers in that way. You've spoken to me in the past about how they're not respected and also how it's difficult at universities and various places to get them to be attracted in there because they're not given a good career path, they're not given good training,
absolutely.
And they're not given much respect, and that is undermining the effectiveness of the system. What are your thoughts about that?
Thank you. You've preached my sermon very well. I've been concerned about the strength of the civil service. You know, people who want to go in the civil service often can be selected, maybe in a school of public administration, say, okay, you got a job, it's February, but we can't have you and can't pay you until the new fiscal year, which is 6 months away. So these people can't sit around with no pay or anything for 6 months, so they go get a job on Wall Street or someplace instead. Now that's typical of the kind of thing that needs to be repaired. But what concerned me is the attitudes toward government itself and the difficulties of getting and attracting and keeping the best people, paralleled by the growing lack of interest as I see it in universities. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, schools has departments or schools or public administration. Public administration is a bad word now. People associate public administration with a bunch of time servers sitting in some government office producing nothing useful. Administration, people don't think that when you say business administration, but they think it when you say government administration. But we have a problem in these schools. Many of them have lost sight of how to teach. What are they teaching? What should the curriculum be? How do we train people to oversee all that outsourcing? Hundreds of billions of dollars being outsourced. Who's minding the store? Are people equipped to do that? Have we taught them the right thing? Have we taught them how to manage? Have we taught them how to debate issues, to write a good memorandum, how to deal with other people, other departments? And so this little Volcker Alliance is trying to get a kind of marriage, a new marriage between universities and the government, state and local government, as well as federal government, to see whether we can develop a stronger sense of interest and efficiency. Last time this was true in the United States was before World War I, when there was a great movement for improving government, and the civil service came into effect. And up through the Depression years, there was a lot of pressure, a lot of done to improve government organization. And a lot of people wanted to go into government. Now we are, 80 years later? We've lost much of that.
So would you say a principle of yours is that in order to have effective government, you have to have effective civil servants?
Whether you call them civil servants or whatever you call them, you have to have people running. I'm with Alexander Hamilton. The true test of government is the ability to get something done efficiently. And we lapse in that respect.
You've been in contact with economics in every country, every major country. Is that a distinguishing characteristic of those that are successful and those that are not?
You have to have a great feeling of commitment to whatever you're doing, whether it's economist or a civil servant. And they still exist. You know, there's still a lot of people in government have a great sense of commitment to doing what's going on. And, you know, look at this present change in government. I think there's something like 700, maybe more, potential presidential appointments in a new government. All the secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, judges, so forth and so on. About a third of those offices are filled. Now, nobody's paying attention. Now, who's running those departments? Well, the civil servants are left there, maybe in good form, maybe not, but leaderless, basically. That isn't the way to run a government. That's just one example of the difficulties we're having these days.
Looking around the world, what are the principles of great government?
Well, obviously, you need a strong leader at the top. That helps quite a lot. But what we are running into is the life of democracies. Are democracies really able to do the kind of thing I'm talking about? Or do they eventually, as Plato said, end up with some plutocracy and you can't really maintain a democracy over a period of years? But you have, you know, countries like France and Germany had a very disciplined, very prestigious civil service. So did the UK. That's deteriorated a lot in recent years because it's considered too elitist, too far removed from the public, actually. And I guess this is a great trick. How can you get the expertise that you need and the leadership that you need and still respect the popular desire? And the vote in the end, and the politicians are going to decide the direction in which to go.
You refer to Plato's cycle in the Republic, the idea, of course, that democracies are threatened. Describe that. And describe how you feel that that pertains to today's situations.
Well, I think you look at the United States that we're very familiar with. You have a very divisive new administration. You have the kind of gridlock that we saw in the Obama administration. I was friendly with Mr. Obama. I was disappointed he couldn't get more done. But here you had a situation where the Congress, in effect, said, the Senate said, whatever Mr. Obama is for, we're against. And they maintained that position for 3 years, really. And did the government suffer from that? Yes. Did it have a really well-designed, efficient healthcare system for the uninsured? Well, it tried very hard, but it was very difficult to develop it and maintain it. And you see symptoms of that sort all over the place now. An inability to reach some reasonable consensus on how to administer certain programs, or how in the first place to get agreement on what the program ought to be. And it's not a phenomenon just for the United States, unfortunately. It's obviously in Eastern Europe, Latin America is a hardship case almost from top to bottom. But even within the established democratic countries in the Euro or in the Eurozone, we're all having some trouble in maintaining the progress that we made internationally in developing a set of international rules and developments that suit everybody, and the feeling that they don't suit everybody, and that too many people have been left out. And I think that's a real problem that Mr. Trump has touched upon, and kind of the real base for his support. But whether we're handling it in the right way is, in my mind, pretty doubtful at the moment.
You had probably the greatest economic challenge, and you were both also the greatest, most powerful man in the country, in the world, actually, in terms of your control of a monetary policy. So 14.8% inflation is where we hit in March of 1980. Right. And as a result of that, you tightened monetary policy. I remember it very well. You set an M1 target of 5.5%. And as a result of that, interest rates went up to 20%.
More than we ever expected.
And when you tighten monetary policy like that, it drove the unemployment rate up to 10%, and it caused the worst downturn in that period of time since the Great Depression. And you held tight in that. There were protests, there was anger, and you held tight in that, and you followed it through. And as a result of that, you broke the back of inflation. And in 1983, that inflation rate went down to 3% inflation at that time. And we began a decade of prosperity, of strong growth with low inflation. Now, you had to have a vision of what it was like. You had to fight through that vision despite all the opposition. That's an example of leadership under people now look back and they say that was a great accomplishment. But at that time, that must have been very difficult. Can you describe
yes.
it? And then also tell us more about what you've seen to be the qualities of great leadership that you've seen in others as well.
Well, this all happened, the fight on inflation itself, 50 years ago, roughly. And people today, people my age are all dying off. And even middle-aged people with children then. And they may not remember the atmosphere as was experienced. The inflation rate had gone up for more than a decade. There were kind of feeble efforts to deal with it. During the Ford administration, they handed out buttons, whip inflation now, but it had more buttons than policy. And there was always this conflict, which always exists. Don't tighten monetary policy too far, you'll get some unemployment. So we went a decade that way, and we got more inflation and more unemployment. And when I took over the Federal Reserve at the end of Carter's administration, President Carter was totally frustrated because he seemed to be unable to take any initiative anyway, because all this inflation was backfiring on him. He couldn't do anything in the budget, couldn't do anything on energy. All these things he would have liked to have seemed to be stalled by this fear of inflation, and it was very real at that time. And so he asked me to become chairman of the Federal Reserve. Well, it was obvious that existing policies weren't working, and actually I was in the Federal Reserve before that, voting against some of those policies. But I decided we had to change in approach, and we got to stop worrying about increasing unemployment at any time. We got to deal with this inflation, or it's going to get worse and worse, because it was accelerating when it got close to 15% annual rate. And if we pussyfooted much longer, it was going to be 20%. And people were really fearful about the stability of the country. So we did tighten. It took a long while, actually, for the unemployment rate to go up. It was very stubborn, and the inflation rate was very stubborn. And we made one or two false moves we had to take back. It looked a little longer than we thought, but I saw no other way to approach this other than kind of a bulldog biting at it straight out. And I got plenty worried in 82 when we did begin getting unemployment, and the damn inflation rate wasn't coming down and the money supply wasn't coming down the way we wanted. But I felt we were stuck. We couldn't back off. All the effort we were making would be for naught. Fortunately, by the summer of 82, things, the money supply came down, inflation rate became coming down. We had a recession, but by the end of the year, it looked like the recession could be over, or at least stop getting worse, and it ended pretty quickly. But it took that last year of sticking with it that I think was necessary to do the job. Now, you talk about how unpopular it was, yeah. The farmers had tractors outside the Federal Reserve. We had community groups. We had one congressman spend every day for 2 years asking for my impeachment. But my sense was the country as a whole understood that inflation was getting us by the throat, and they were willing to sit back and not be too aggressive because they thought I was attacking a problem that needed to be attacked. And I had more support, I think. I know I did. A good measure of that was when my reappointment came on at the end of this process. I was first nominated. It was unanimous. Nominated 4 years later. It was not unanimous. I had 8 Democrats voting against me, 8 Republicans. They were 8 left-wing Democrats, 8 right-wing Republicans, and 84 votes with me. And I think that was a fair representation that people, things were getting better then, but people tolerated what it took to deal with the inflation problem. And I don't think there was any other answer, frankly. I console myself. It was a tough time, but do you have any other answer to where
you went? No, I remember you going through it. Every single day, I was wondering what Paul Volcker was thinking since you set that. You set the M1 target at 5.5%, and I did the calculations of velocity, and I thought, oh my God, is that really going to be happening? Because you have a 14% inflation, that means the interest rates have got to go up.
It was interesting.
So it was a time. People don't have any understanding of that, how challenging that time was. We think of 2008, but the 1982, the unemployment rate rising to 10%, the rate at which the economy plunged, all of those conditions were worse than in 1982, not 2008. Well, so it was a more dramatic time, even in terms of volatility of interest rates.
What people forget about going back then as compared to 2008, we had a bankrupt Latin America. And the banks had head over heels in lending to Latin America. They had 1.5 to 2 times their capital, not just big American banks, but big international banks elsewhere, invested in Latin America. One day, Mexico said, we can't pay anymore.
August 1982.
And what happened? Well, we, by hook and by crook, and with the help of the IMF, which is very important, we stalled. Stalled for time. And you go, oh, this is not very dramatic. But we got the banks, because it was in their own interest to continue lending enough to pay interest anyway. We forced constructive reforms, we thought, on Mexico, Brazil, Argentina. A lot of that's been lost since. But that was with the help of the IMF. And it held together. We didn't have a banking collapse. It wasn't subprime mortgages. It was subprime subprime Latin American borrowers.
It was a good example of how you could roll things forward from 1982 until 1991 when they had the Brady bond.
That is correct. And things, capital had been restored, some of the debts had been lowered, and he could finish it off with the so-called Brady plan, yes.
You have known most world leaders for most of the last 50, 60, 70 years. Tell me, what are your principles about what makes a great world leader or a great leader in general?
Well, sometimes when you get close to them, they don't seem so great. But, you know, when you look around at world leaders in recent years, who do you begin thinking of? I think Mrs. Merkel did a pretty good job in Europe and Germany.
We had dinner with Lee Kuan Yew, you and I,
Lee Kuan Yew was the next name I was going to mention. And the third name I was going to mention is, I don't know how much you ran into Zhu Rongji.
He's been a hero of mine. I didn't know him personally.
Well, he was a hero of mine. This was in the 1990s when I was to China quite a lot. I don't go to China very little now. And I don't know the leaders now, but I knew the leaders in the 90s when they seemed to be a blossoming capitalist economy, you know, to exaggerate a bit, with hopes for an open democratic society. Didn't look that way quite now, but back when Deng and Zhu Rongji were there, it looked very promising. And they come to us for advice. They don't come for us for advice anymore. They might come to us and tell us what to do. But
well, they seem to be doing pretty good.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They say we don't have to follow you anymore. But Lee Kuan Yew, of course, is a special case. Here he is.
What are those qualities?
Well, he knew what he wanted to get done, and he did it in a small relative enclave. And he did a lot of things that we tutted about in terms of democracy, that he was a little too eager to put people in jail and to quiet down opposition and worry about what the newspaper said about him and so forth. But he had a drive to develop Singapore with a very strong civil service, very effective, corrupt-free government, as near as I could see. And he pulled it off, and he maintained a very strong position. And Singapore is, economically, I don't know where it ranks in the world by per capita income, but it's
way up there,
very high.
So your principles, if I get it correctly, your principles would be a great leader has an accurate vision of where to go. A great leader will fight the opposition in pursuit of that and deliver. A great leader has a deep caring for the people that they're leading. A great leader also seems to be leading with an effective management of civil service in government or a effective bureaucracy to carry those things through. Are those the principles?
Well, I think we have to add a principle, the one you had. You've got to have a respect for the people. I don't know whether you included that. You know, some of the qualities you mentioned, you could apply to Adolf Hitler. But we don't want an Adolf Hitler. We got somebody that's got some democratic instincts and recognizes that he's only there temporarily and that he wants to lead the country effectively but peaceably and without dictatorial demands. So it's a nice balance to be charged, and maybe less efficient when you have to deal with public opinion and differing points of view. But it's obviously essential if democracy is going to last. We legitimately worry about democracy now. My mother, who was quite a character herself, I recall vaguely whining to her when I was probably a young man in government, Vietnam War or something, rioting in streets, a race upon how we were threatened, the country was threatened to survive all these tensions. She said, Sonny boy, she didn't call me Sonny boy, but she said, we're 200 years of democracy. We've been a longer democracy than anybody else in the world. We've gotten over worse than this before. Go get back to work and do something. And I take a little comfort in that thought that we can straighten ourselves out after this little turmoil. Not so little turmoil.
What do you see the United States' future, China's future, over the next 10 years, let's say?
Well, you know, I sometimes, sounds terrible, but I respond more favorably to what the president of China is saying than the president of the United States. The president of China at least says that he's looking forward to a harmonious relationship over time. Undoubtedly, he's looking for the world being divided up to different spheres of influence, and that China will take care of the Asian sphere. But looking for peaceable outcomes where we're all threats and demands. So it's a different story being told. Now, there's some justice, of course, in what Trump is doing. It is true during our period of leadership, we tended to overlook in our own country some of the problems that world leadership implied in terms of willing to accept a lot of imports in particular. And we began getting overwhelmed with imports, and it's only part of the sections. Didn't bother Wall Street, doesn't bother California, but it bothered all those small manufacturers and not so small manufacturers that were losing out. And it's true, we do have a big current account deficit. It's not all China, but in China no longer has a big surplus that it had worldwide. So we may not be analyzing this all correctly, but there's no doubt we've had some unevenness in repercussions in the United States, which present a real political problem, and we've got to resolve it.
That political problem is the polarity. That political problem is the wealth gap. Describe the political problem.
Well, to reach some agreement upon what an appropriate influx under what conditions immigrants are. We've, in recent years, taken a lot of immigrants. Maybe we don't want so many. But what should the rules be, both in terms of our economic needs, but in terms of our moral needs when people are being oppressed in different ways? And how can we develop an economy that's more balanced between the great middle part of the country and the two coastal areas where a lot of the vigor seems to exist? And that's a big challenge. It's not going to be healed overnight. What are we going to do about the big issues of, from my point of view, climate change? We don't seem to be able to reach and work with other countries effectively in that area, which may kill the whole next generation if we don't worry about it. So there are a lot of issues that somehow have been polarized to the extent we're having great difficulty in achieving the consensus that we need.
Paul, what would you like your legacy to be?
Oh, God, my legacy. I'd like to see my legacy a more effective government in general. I haven't got any control over the high politics or any influence, but I would like to see a general acceptance of the need for an efficient public service ethic and see people attracted toward public service because they can take satisfaction that they're doing something concrete for the country and the people generally. And it can certainly test their own acumen and intelligence and energy to do that kind of thing. My father, I'm sure, got restive about spending so much time in government, but I'm sure that in the end, he found that a satisfying career and didn't make a lot of money, made enough to live on, simply enough. I would like to see that kind of spirit permeate a wider population. And it once did, there's no doubt about it. When I grew up, when I got out of college, when I got out of graduate school, going into government was a popular thing to do. Now people scratch their head and say, why would you ever want to do that? And that's not a very healthy sign, which goes along with the 20% confidence in government to do things right. Back when Kennedy came in, it was overdone. With all the spirit that he had, and I was a young man and full of Kennedy glamour or respect for it. You asked that same question, do you trust your government? It got up 60 or 70%, said yes. So that's a healthy, we should be skeptical. I want 30% to be skeptical. I want more than 30% to be skeptical. Being skeptical is one thing, but being anti-government is another thing. We repair it, we don't dismiss it.
What does the Volcker Alliance do?
We are a young and small organization, but we're trying to get some cohesiveness with what we perceive, many people perceive, about the needs of government for effective administration and effective people, and get better connection between the needs of the government and the universities with schools of public administration or public policy that can feed this potential demand more effectively than it's been done recently. The recruitment between the federal government and young people and between these universities is so lax, it's almost disappeared. And that's not right. These universities have to review what they're doing to see how they can really educate effectively. And the government has to cooperate with them and see what kind of people they need and how they need to be trained, how they can be employed with a minimum of red tape and delays, and be given satisfying jobs. Because there's no doubt that a lot of challenges in government, a lot of opportunities for challenging jobs.
How would you hope that the government would work with the Volcker Alliance to visualize that goal? What parts of the government would do what?
You ask a sensitive question. We're examining precisely that issue. There are people in the OMB, Office of Management and Budget. The management part of that has been very weak, but it still exists. It's been there, I guess, since the, I don't know, Truman administration. That should be a central focus for government management with a few experts and interested people. They now are taking an initiative to do precisely what I'm talking about. So we had seven or eight questions. We asked all 50 states, with the help of some of the universities, how are you doing in budgeting? How are you doing? Are you got funds reserved for emergencies? How's your pension system? And three or four other questions. We published a nice, shiny book. All the states were ranked. Didn't rank them in order, but we said, are you doing a good job, bad job, impossible job? And it's attracted a lot of attention because there's competition between the states. So people say, oh my God, here we got a report by the Volcker Alliance that says we don't have good budgeting arrangements. So some of them have actually changed their budgeting procedures.
That's a good example of the impact of the Volcker Alliance being able to put the grades on those for everybody to see changes behavior.
You know, everybody talks about infrastructure. Nobody's doing anything about it, that I can see anyway. You know, such obvious infrastructure projects as new rail tunnels under the Hudson. We're sitting here with leaking tunnels, totally dependent upon these two very fragile existing pieces of infrastructure that we built more than 100 years ago. What are we wasting time on a few blocks of the Second Avenue subway? Why are we wasting a lot of time with some elaborate way of bringing two or three Long Island trains in the Grand Central Station when big, obvious needs are going undone? So I'm trying to make a little project to bring out some of those problems. And does it take a federal government leadership to somehow bring people together to see which are the most urgent of these infrastructure problems, and to what extent should the federal government, that inevitably gets involved, be doing the financing and checking its viability, and working with the states and cities? And it's just not being done now in the way it should be done. And the states are all being squeezed financially, which makes it all more difficult.
How can others help you achieve your legacy and the Volcker Alliance?
Well, they can look it up on their iPhone. I guess they can see, but we do need some money, and we're at a point where, you know, we've got some money to function this year, next year, but we're going to continue after that. We're going to need some influx of real money. We're a very small organization, but it's interesting what you can do with a small organization. But we do have to get, and we're going to spend this year making another try of demanding more cooperation from the universities themselves, because they potentially have more resources than we have. But public administration, public management, they put a lot of money in the business management, not putting money in the public management. Economics, it was a prestigious, hesitate to call it a science, but it's got great prestige, or did, until it missed the 2008 crisis pretty completely. Economists have lost a lot of prestige, I think, in recent years, and rightfully so. But the amount of money that's been poured into economic research, as compared to the amount of money poured into research and public administration, is astonishing. It just hasn't got the same respect. My old University of Princeton once got a huge donation for public management, training for public service. Where's the money? It goes to the economics department, to oversimplify. When I went to Princeton, the president of Princeton was a professor of public administration. I tell people that now in the economics department. They don't believe it. Woodrow Wilson was the father of public administration, president of Princeton. One of the things he did not touch upon, but which I think are a big problem, is the amount of corruption in the world. Fiduciary responsibility seems to vanish from the lexicon. Doesn't vanish from their statements, the nice statements of ethics that they print. But when it gets down to the trading desk, or it gets down to making a deal with Malaysia with a big payoff, you wonder whether the ethical standards ever get down to the people doing the work. And the enormous number of conflicts of interest that have developed in banks and elsewhere in finance.
I did a study of what made countries succeed and fail with a 10-year time horizon, looked at different indicators. And there's a negative 52% correlation, in other words, a very strong negative correlation between the level of corruption and the level of relative growth. You recently received a lot of attention for making the statement that, related to government, that it's a hell of a mess all around. And I think you were talking more broadly, but clarify what you mean by that.
We have fake news. You don't know what to believe, what not to believe. You've got presidents that don't seem to mind either personal behavior or making outrageous statements, true or not. You have a Congress that's been unable to function effectively. Now, hopefully that'll change a little bit. But we'll wait and see after this past election. But we have not been on a constructive track. I think that's fair to say. We rammed through a massive tax bill. Whatever you think about that tax bill, shouldn't be rammed through the Congress without any debates at midnight on December 31st or whatever was done, with almost nobody in the Congress having a very good idea of what was in the bill, whether you like what was in or not. It's not, it wasn't subject to the right kind of debate that we should have had. But that seems to be true in other areas as well. No, I just refer you to the morning press if you want to know a description of how effective government is these days.
So a lot of people have claimed that we've always had challenges in government and we've been through these things.
Including my mother. Well, in my lifetime, yes. I think there was a general after World War II again when we were king of the crop. There was a broad consensus about the broad outlines of foreign policy. And there was a willingness of both Republican and Democratic presidents to kind of lead what? NATO, lead the World Trade Organization, lead the whole effort to reduce tariffs. That all went hand in hand. There were a lot of debates about it, but the basic core of the policy was generally accepted. And that's changed. And we're not always going to have happy harmony about what policy should be. But you got to do a little better than we've been doing recently. I go back to what I think I said some time ago. Of all the presidential appointments, far less than half anybody's even been nominated, much less appointed. The quality of the people appointed to cabinet offices or sub-cabinet offices, I think by any estimation, is not up to scratch. That didn't say there are not good and effective appointments. But when you see lobbyists for polluting companies named head of the agency for anti-pollution, you wonder by the coherent nature of the appointment. And it's happening too often. State Department's ripped apart. Maybe it should be ripped apart. But it ought to be done in a constructive way. We haven't had an ambassador in Saudi Arabia. We have all these problems in Saudi Arabia. We haven't even got an ambassador there until now. Why not? I mean, too much policy seems to be out of the back pocket today, and God knows what happens tomorrow. Look, for an old government man like me, it doesn't look very good. Hence my comment. Let's hope it gets better.
Well, thank you, Paul, for spending this time and also conveying some of your principles and also some of what you're hoping will be achieved over the next few years to make up your legacy. I hope that we can help you achieve that.
Well, thank you for coming. I appreciate the opportunity to rant and rave a little bit because I think the country needs a little ranting and raving.
And you do that so well.
Yeah, I don't know about that.